Ron Kovic was really born on the 4th of July. 40 years ago, the Vietnam vet, wounded in combat and in a wheelchair ever since, published his classic war memoir, later made into a film with Tom Cruise, Born on the 4th of July. The new anniversary edition of the book features a foreword by Bruce Springsteen. In addition, Kovic, who continues his activism, has written a new memoir, Hurricane Street, which chronicles the 1970s activism of the American Veterans Movement. It is a great pleasure to welcome Ron Kovic to the roundtable this morning. Ron, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thank you very much, Joe. It's great to be with you.
First of all, can you believe it's been 40 years since this book
came out?
Well,
I'm going to be turning 70 on the 4th of July, and it's 40 years. It's gone by very quickly in many ways, yes.
What was it?
I was 27 when I wrote Born on the 4th of July, and it came out on my 30th birthday, and I began Hurricane Street about 3.5 years ago, and it's going to be coming out on my 70th. Now, that was the 200th birthday of the country back in 1976, the bicentennial, and now we will be celebrating our 240th birthday as a country.
When you look at the book of Born on the 4th of July and what it has accomplished as far as the story that it tells, your story, and the eyes that it opened over the past four decades, I assume that when you look at that, you have to be proud of the story.
Oh, absolutely, Joe. I'm very grateful. I went out and I bought the fall of 1974. I went out to a Sears and Roebuck in Santa Monica, California, and I purchased a $42 manual typewriter, a Brother typewriter, and 500 blank sheets of paper. I had never written a book in my life, and I took it back to my apartment in Santa Monica, and in about 1 month, 3 weeks, and 2 days, I completed the first draft of Born on the 4th of July. I never imagined that I would be able to reach so many people. I had no idea there was going to be a movie made, much less that Tom Cruise was going to portray my life story in that film, in that particular movie. But I'm just proud and grateful and thankful and deeply appreciative for the opportunity to be able to send a message of peace and nonviolence, hopefully an inspirational message, to as many people as possible.
And this comes, the book comes, and that spotlight after, as you write in the book, of just you trying to get 2 minutes with Roger Mudd on CBS at the end of the book, of how important that
I
was.
I remember that, you know. But, well, back then, I was very gung-ho as a young man. I remember being inspired by John F. Kennedy's famous speech, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And both my mother and father had served in the Navy during World War II. My mother was a Wave, and they joined not long after Pearl Harbor, as many Americans did back then, December 7th, 1941, I believe it was. And I grew up in a very patriotic neighborhood in Massapequa, Long Island, and I had two uncles that served both in World War II and during the Korean War in the United States Marine Corps. I had the Marine Corps guidebook when I was 9, and I would practice saluting in front of a mirror. So not to mention the fact that I was born on the 4th of July, which as a young boy I was very proud of that. I volunteered for my first tour of duty. Well, I volunteered to join the Marine Corps in September of 1964 out of high school, and I grew up in pretty much of a working class background. My dad was an A&P food store manager, and my mom was a housewife. I had three other brothers and two sisters. I decided to join the Marine Corps. I always wanted a challenge. I was very athletic as a young man. My dream had been actually, Joe, to play for the New York Yankees, but I never had that opportunity, so I joined the Marine Corps, and I graduated from Parris Island boot camp in the late fall of 1964. It was not long after that. A couple of months later, I volunteered for my first tour of duty in Vietnam. I went over in, I believe it was around December of 65, just as our involvement in Vietnam was beginning, and I did a 13-month tour with the Marine Corps, and then after coming home and spending several months in the States, I actually was stationed at Cherry Point, North Carolina for a while. I volunteered to go back to Vietnam. I was just very determined to... it's really interesting because I eventually ended up protesting the very war I fought in, but at that particular juncture, I volunteered a second time to go back to Vietnam because I wanted to be like my father and the fathers of my neighborhood and the fathers who I'd grown up around on my block in Long Island, who had participated in World War II, had been part of the victory of World War II, and I was determined to win in that war. And after the second tour, and after being wounded in January of 1968, January 20th, 1968 to be exact, I ended up going through several different intensive care ward. I received the last rites of the Catholic Church. I was lucky to be alive. I had been shot in the front of my foot. It blew out the back of my heel. I got shot in the front of my chest a few moments later while leading my squad across an open area toward a village. And on that that January 20th, 1968, on that Friday afternoon. And then I took a bullet through my right shoulder, went through my right lung, hit my spine, and paralyzed me from my mid-chest down permanently. And the first Marine who came up to get me from behind was shot in the heart, and he died almost immediately. A second Marine, a few minutes later, came and lifted me up and carried me back under heavy fire, and just took off. And pretty soon, I found myself in several different hospitals, the Da Nang Intensive Care Ward, Japan, and then back to the States. Eventually, I went to the Bronx VA, which the May 1970 Life magazine article depicted the scandalous conditions, overcrowded, some of the most severely wounded of that war not being cared for properly. That affected me very deeply, and slowly but surely, it was not immediate, but I began to slowly change and turn against the war. I went to a university on the G.I. Bill, Hofstra University on Long Island, just for a couple of months. I was very restless during that period, but I tried to go back to school, and it was during that period that I was influenced as well by what was happening on the campus. And in particular, and I'll stop, but Kent State University, I believe it was May 4th, 1970, when the students were killed at Kent State during the protests. That affected me profoundly, and that was the first time I attended, actually allowed myself to attend a demonstration against the war.
You obviously tell that story in Born on the 4th of July, and the new book, Hurricane Street, tells the story of a very specific period of time, a movement in 1974 that you initiated, to change how Veterans Affairs, the VA hospitals, cured and cared for wounded soldiers. As you said a moment ago, there was great overcrowding, great concern as to the treatment, poor treatment, and it was a universal problem. And one of the things that you realize in reading this book all of these years later is how by most, if not well, to be conservative to say many accounts, is that a VA hospital system that is still very much broken.
Yes, we still have many challenges across the country. But I must say, that in the spinal cord injury clinic and hospital in Long Beach, the one that I write about in Hurricane Street, the one that we actually protested against, and other VA hospitals around the country in the spring of 1974, when we actually disabled veterans in wheelchairs ended up having to camp out in a United States senator's office for a 19-day occupation and a 17-day hunger strike It's just outrageous that some of our most traumatic and catastrophic injuries, paraplegics and quadriplegics who had lost most of their bodies in that war, had to go on a hunger strike in a United States senator's office, laying on the floor, going on a hunger strike. That's just, there's a certain absurdity to that, that that had to happen at all. But what I want to say is that I still go to the Long Beach VA 40 years later, and improvements have occurred. It's gotten, I actually was hospitalized about a year and a half ago for at least a month and a half, and I found the caregivers to be much more respectful. I found it to be a much more professional approach. They tore down the old, as I write in the epilogue of Hurricane Street, they tore down the old SCI building, the one where we had so many problems, and they rebuilt a new SCI center, which is actually a very beautiful center. They tore down the old SCI, Spinal Cord Injury Center, and they built a center for sight-impaired veterans. What I want to say is that my feelings are that if the changes could occur in Long Beach, and I know we have many problems. Our suicide rate is, 18 to 22 of our young Iraq and Afghan veterans commit suicide every day. That's absolutely unconscionable. It's unacceptable. It's outrageous that these precious young men and women who wore the uniform, who served our country, who in many cases risked their lives, are put on a waiting list. And some of them are in critical condition psychologically. They're trying to get into the VA. They need immediate help. They can't wait. That so many of them have taken their lives since both the Iraq and Afghan war have winded down. But what I'm saying is that I believe that if improvements can occur in that hospital that we had so many problems with back in the spring of 1974, I really believe that changes can occur in other VA facilities around the country. And I really want to encourage anyone who works in a VA facility to remember this is not just a 9-to-5 job. This is more than just a bureaucracy. This is a commitment to these young men and women who wore the uniform of this country and who deserve to be treated with respect, who deserve the very best care. And I really believe that we need to work as a team and we need to have a mutual respect. And I'm optimistic that if we strive toward that, we can actually make these improvements. So we really owe our veterans the very best possible, not just the best hospitals possible, but care throughout their lives, the best GI Bill. We can't do enough of them as far as I'm concerned.
I'm struck by what you are saying because it seems as though for fundamental changes to happen within the system, it almost would take another drastic action like you and your colleagues did in 1974 in Senator Alan Cranston's office, meaning that it takes something like that to put it on the radar of people who are home and to see how it is affecting.
I agree with you completely. And if several veterans or a group of veterans took that particular peaceful, nonviolent action, I would absolutely support it 100%. Does it shake things up? Absolutely. I admire that type of resistance. I mean, we can't remain silent forever. I mean, especially with these injustices still going on after decades, problems that don't seem to be not being dealt with. Well, yeah, I agree with you completely. And I'm not saying I wrote the book to encourage people to take over a senator's office, but what I am saying is that when there is injustice, when people are not being treated like human beings and are not being treated with the respect that they deserve, they have every right to not only raise their voice, but to take action, as Martin Luther King did during the Civil Rights Movement, as we've seen many people do, not only in this country, but around the world, who deal with impossible situations where people are just not being treated with respect and treated like human beings.
Why do you think it is so often veterans who are left behind or forgotten?
You know, that's a very difficult question. I'm really reflecting on what you just said. You know, I don't know what it is. I just sometimes I think there's a disconnect between the average citizen and those who participate and those who serve our country. I don't know. Let me ask you, Joe. What do you think? What would be your response to that? And maybe we can start a dialogue here. You know.
Well, I guess it seems as though, and again, I'm still struck by what you were saying a moment ago about the.
Oh, I think one person. If I can interrupt, I think one person can make a difference. I mean, listen. I took over that building because I knew something had to be done because nothing was being done. But at the same time, I know that, you know, just treating someone with respect, I mean, I know that attitudes can make a difference, too.
It just seems that so often we use veterans as a political football and say that we're supporting them, we're supporting them, we're supporting them. But then when you go to their hospitals, you go to what they are paid, you go to what they are given in support following their service to this country, it seems to be woefully inadequate. And my question is, why do you believe that so often happens and that the great spotlight that comes when people are running for office and when people are talking about the veterans of this country with great pride, that they are not in turn treated in a more proper sense?
Well, it's easy to say welcome home, and it's easy to say thank you for fighting for our freedom. But that's not always the case. You know, that's not always what's happening out there. Often our young men and women are sent to these theaters of conflict, and needlessly and unnecessarily, you know, we must not waste lives unnecessarily. I don't know. I just think it's lip service. It's easy for them to say that, and to say, you know, we support our veterans. You are all heroes and everything else. I mean, it's not just the words and the rhetoric, but do you really mean it? Are you really committed? Are you really serving those who need? I mean, are you really caring for them properly in the hospital? Are you really following them throughout their lives? Do you really care about them? I think I said recently in an interview that, you know, we should see each and every young man and woman who goes over there. What if you saw them as your own son and daughter? You cared for them that much because that's who they really are, and that's how we have to respond to them and relate to them.
Ron Kovic is the author of Born on the 4th of July, which is out in a 40th anniversary edition, a beautiful edition. It is also marks the publication of Hurricane Street, which is a new memoir. Hurricane Street, which is also out both from Akashic Books. And we should note in all of this that the 4th of July is your birthday. So we wish you a very happy 70th birthday. And I thank you very much for being on the program this morning.
Thank you, Joe. And I'd like to wish our country a very happy 240th birthday on that day as well.
Ron Kovic, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thank you, Joe. You have a great day.
Thank you. Again, Ron Kovic's new book is Hurricane Street, and of course, Born on the 4th of July is now out in its 40th anniversary edition. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.